I'm going to bring it down by a few octaves as I read the Bible. You'll find on the inside of the information sheet, James chapter 4, verses 1 to 12. It is a great song, though. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the Scripture says he yearns jealously over the Spirit that he has made to dwell in us? But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbour?
Thanks, Andrew. Weddings are one of the most frightening things I know, and I've been very close to quite a lot of them. There is something in the Bible about a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And that seems pretty simple, and it's clear from that who is involved. Man, woman, joining together. And then the New Testament helps us to understand the one flesh bit by talking about them loving each other in really important ways. Really simple, and we can see who it is about. But then when 21st century man and the 21st century woman, when, say, let's call them Zechariah and Elizabeth, They let people know that they want to join up with each other, like in Genesis, it stops being clear who it's about. Elizabeth tells her good friend Anna, and Anna wants to be the bridesmaid. Anna has always wanted to be Elizabeth's bridesmaid. But that means that the wedding cannot happen in April the way that Zechariah and Elizabeth want, because Anna has got to be in Venezuela next week for work and she won't be back here until November, so I have to put it off till then. And then it turns out that Zechariah's sister needs to be bridesmaid as well. And Anna is about 2 metres tall and has fluffy red hair, and Zechariah's sister is short and very dark, and somehow it is necessary to work out how to have matching clothes for them while one of them is on the other side of the world.
Then the parents get involved.
Zechariah and Elizabeth just wanted to be together. And they had a vague idea that they could get married in some ceremony somewhere and their parents and some friends would come along and then they'd get on with life. What neither of them knew until this moment is that Elizabeth's mother has a very well worked out idea of Elizabeth's wedding. it has been taking shape in her mind for 30 years. Elizabeth's only 25. The building, the music, the relatives, the food. It is, in fact, the wedding that Elizabeth's mother's parents did not give her 30 years ago. And she has been saving it up ever since, ready for the moment when she can inflict it on Elizabeth. But it gets better. Zechariah and Elizabeth and their families are from South India. And as soon as marriage comes on the menu, Zechariah's father is thinking of rupees. Not what it's going to cost him, but what he can get out of Elizabeth's family in money and real estate and gifts. Zechariah's father knows that Elizabeth's family are loaded, and he thinks this wedding is the best thing that's ever happened. Or the other way around. The other way around. Zechariah and Elizabeth and their families are from South Sudan. And as soon as there's marriage in the air, Elizabeth's parents are thinking about cows. Or money in place of cows. And before any marriage, there is going to be a big negotiation to fix the value in cows. Now, I know, and this is where it does get complicated, all those people are involved. And we haven't even started on the musicians, or the friend who designs the clothes, or grandma who is really anxious that her mother's ring needs to be used on the day, or the grumpy minister who thinks that it's all about him. Loads of people are involved. But Zechariah's parents, Elizabeth's parents, Zechariah's sister, Anna. When they get married, there will be a new connection between their families. There will be a change in the workings of all those connections. But it's mostly about Zechariah and Elizabeth. And that bit seems really, really difficult for anyone else to work out. And the stress and the pain and the fights over the most amazing things.
Mind, even the most frightening weddings I've been in are calm and relaxed compared to the simplest funerals I've been involved with, but that is a story for another day.
But each of the people involved in the wedding, even the grandma, they've got this sense inside them of, this thing is about me. They will never say it like that, but they feel the passion. And they find it hard, really hard, in the stress of the wedding to see it from anyone else's point of view. And that's not just weddings, is it? The point of view thing. Take a look at this fossil comic from the 1950s. We can have a competition later to see who recognises which book it comes from. Murray might have it straight away, I don't know. But okay, there they are. It's all right, he's got kids of an age to read this, so he knows. They're hitchhiking. A car, let's summer lift. Car goes past. There ought to be a law to make those infernal mileage merchants stop when people signal. Okay, point of view when you're trying to hitchhike. A couple of pages later, they have managed to get a lift, and then we find hitchhikers. Blistering barnacles, there ought to be a law against them. It's your point of view. As it is at this exact moment. You know? Point of view. How come she got the job and I didn't? My experience and qualifications were as good as hers, if not better. How come he scored higher for his essay? Mine was as good as his. How come you got invited for that fortnight on Heron Island and I didn't? Verse 1. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this,
that your passions are at war within you? What causes fights and quarrels? What causes those splits between families and friends? What causes fights and quarrels? Tom and Kathy were great friends of mine, especially Kathy, and Tom and Kathy were an item. Then Tom and Kathy split up. Now, I was going to the theatre. I was single at the time, so we're in a different time with this one. I was single and I was going to the theatre with a group of friends and I had a spare ticket. So I got on the phone to Kathy. Would she like to come? Dinner with my friends and then along to the play? Well, yes, she would like to come. Then next morning, the day after, Kathy agreed to come along. The first thing in the morning, I come to the gate of the train station and there's Tom. Until that moment, I had never realised how much bigger than me he was. And he very politely let me know that he wanted to knock my block off. Bit of a standoff, really. My block stayed on, but I wasn't Tom's friend anymore, or not for a very long time. James says, "You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel." That's the thing, isn't it? I want. Whether I want the wedding to happen my way, whether I want Kathy to go out with me, not you, I want my share of the stuff. I desire and do not have. And my desire is so strong that there is a whole industry around putting stuff in front of me so that I can desire it. The internet keeps complaining to me that I use Adblock. You know, please deactivate Adblock so that this software can run. But I find even with Adblock happening, our beloved advertisers keep putting stuff in front of me all the time so that I can want and desire and covet. It's great. I go and buy, say, a microphone cord online and I bought it now, I've got the one that I need, but for the next 6 weeks I keep getting little ads. You want to buy a microphone cord? No thanks, I just bought one. But we know, in our kind of economy, me coveting things makes the world go round. Me coveting and buying stuff, whether I need it or not, is good news for industry. What do I want it for? Verse 1, your passions. Verse 3, your passions. What the advertisers know is that they can count on a world full of people whose desires for love and pleasure and sugar and status and things, those desires are hardwired into the brain in such a way that they can just press the button that says, my passions, and the lights come on. So we get verse 2. You do not have because you do not ask. Now, careful here because there's a bit of a giveaway. Do not ask in this verse is like in chapter 1. James chapter 1, let him ask God. It's asking in prayer. After all, Jesus said, ask and you will receive. But James hits the nail on the head in verse 3. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. And when he says you ask wrongly, it's not you ask wrongly like you use the wrong words, or that prayer was technically slightly wrong. You didn't say amen properly or something, so God will not be able to answer that one because you asked wrongly. Now, ask wrongly because if we ask for this stuff, it immediately gives away where our heart is. like in chapter 1, the double-minded man, the one who wants this world, but then he wants God at the same time. This world, God, this world. So James says he is unstable in all his ways, and that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. I mean, you can imagine it, can't you? All of those wedding people are praying for their version of it. Zechariah's father praying for lots of money. Elizabeth's mother praying for a big showy event. Anna the bridesmaid praying that the engagement will go on and on and on for a really long time until she can come back to Australia. Zechariah's sister praying that it won't go on and on and on for a long time so that she gets to wear something that suits her. Elizabeth's father praying for lots of cows. Putting any of that in prayer in front of God would immediately show, look at me, I am double-minded. I am praying, but in my heart I really think it's all about me. Even somebody else's wedding is all about me. Is the book at the centre of the universe? Now, not quite, but this book has caused an awful lot of trouble. It was written just after the New Testament by a Greek called Ptolemy. And it's all about what everyone always knew anyway. The earth stands still at the centre of the universe, and the sun and the planets and things all go round it. Earth at the centre. Now, you know what this chap is, don't you? He's an orrery, a lovely little working model of the solar system with gears and wheels so that you can wind it up and make the planets move around in the right way and at the right speed. We don't generally get orreries of Ptolemy's version of the world. The first orrery was made at the beginning of the 1700s by the Earl of Orrery. And that was after everything had changed. But sometimes someone will have a shot at making one of Ptolemy's version just for fun. Us in the middle of everything, held up by Meccano, and everything else revolving around us. And Ptolemy's version was so powerful that it didn't just become the standard way of thinking about space and the planets in Europe in the Middle Ages, but the medievals read all sorts of things through Ptolemy-coloured glasses. So you had the Ptolemy version of God's relationship with the universe, the Ptolemy version of life after death, the Ptolemy version of Jesus' return, and of course the Ptolemy version of how your day is going to go when Jupiter is in Sagittarius and Venus is rising. But the influence that Ptolemy had on Christian people in Europe in the Middle Ages is massive, which is not bad for a pagan Greek from Egypt. But then in the 1500s, old Copernicus very softly suggests that Ptolemy is not the way things are at all. Now, he wasn't first, and he wasn't the only, but he is the big Western name in this. Move the earth out from the centre and make it go round the sun, and everything works much better. It is so normal, I think, for us to think of the solar system this way now. But it's not obvious. Not when you're standing there watching things go across the sky. Ptolemy and his mates weren't stupid. And you need a jolly good reason if you're going to say, we are not at the centre of everything. And after Copernicus, poor old Galileo pointed his telescope at the sky and gave us some jolly good reasons to think that we are not at the centre of everything. And we have the Galilean Revolution. And Galileo could show anyone else what he had seen through his telescope. Now, okay, Galileo, as it happens, Galileo was a pretty obnoxious person and politically naive, but he did watch through his telescope the moons of Jupiter going round and round Jupiter, not round us. As some of Galileo's irritating enemies even quoted at him from the Bible. Not bits in the Bible about the earth standing still, but the bit from the book of Acts when Jesus has just returned to heaven and the disciples are all standing around looking into the sky and the angel says, "Men, Galileans, why do you stand looking into heaven?" And it works because Galileo's family was named after the Sea of Galilee. And it fails to work because it is a really, really corny 1600s joke. Kind of 1600s dad joke or something. But would Galileo's opponents believe the evidence of their own eyes with Galileo's telescope? Not when it moving Earth from the centre, no thank you. Earth at the centre of the universe is really important for my ego. Earth at the centre makes us pretty important beasties. But then here's the book that is really at the centre of the universe. It's the human heart. And it tells me I am at the centre. I am what it's all about. My pleasure, my desire, my friend's wedding. All the fights and the quarrels that I've ever been in that include the words, "but you don't even care how I feel," as though that is the most important thing that there can be. Stimulating the pleasure centres of my brain. Maybe your heart doesn't work like that? You try this quick quiz. You're standing in a queue. Imagine you are standing in the queue at a bus stop and it's raining. So this could have been yesterday or the day before. There are 15 people in that queue and you are the eighth. But when the bus comes, it is already very full and it doesn't look like there's going to be room for everyone. How many people do you really want to be able to squeeze onto that bus? 15? 8? My appointment is more important than anyone else's. Who is at the centre of the universe? No wonder we have fights and quarrels. So what is the answer? James calls us to the Galilean Revolution. And here is the telescope that we look through. Verse 4. "Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God?" That is stark, but there it is. The world here is the world that revolves around me. Life in a world that exists for my passion, my comfort. Verse 6. "God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble." Here's the beginning of the revolution that God wants to see in us. See, what is proud? I am at the centre. The point is to change the centre. Look through the telescope. I am not at the centre. That is the most arrogant thing that I could come up with. James calls for a reality check. Whose universe is this? Is it mine? Did I make it? Am I in charge of it? Or for that matter, whose am I? Is there any reality to my talk about belonging to God and loving Him? Or is it just talk? So kicking and screaming, I need to be dragged from the centre. Verse 8. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Humble yourselves before the Lord. Here's the Galilean revolution. The man from Galilee at the centre. The Lamb on the throne. And I need to stand before him and recognise that and rewire the brain that says the most important thing in the known universe is for me to get what gives me my passions. But there's the problem. Suppose I go with James. Do the Galilean revolution. Step out from the centre. I come near to God. Humble and sorry, and at last owing up that the universe belongs to him, not me. Suppose I do all that. What's it going to do about my fights and quarrels? I mean, can't I just go from being a selfish, self-centered person who thinks that the whole universe should lie at my feet? Can't I go from that and turn into a selfish, religious person? So I say, right, God is at the centre, so now I'm going to lock myself up in my religious life and contemplate him. And you can bring me my meals on time, and you can clean up after me and iron my clothes and trim my fingernails while I contemplate the God at the centre of everything. That doesn't sound a lot different from having myself at the centre. What's to stop me? Well, it's completing the Galilean revolution. God has given his love to us. Something that James leaves unsaid, because it's in the background all the way. Think of Jesus, the Galilean. And here's the real revolution. Remember how James started his letter. James, a servant of God and of the Lord, Jesus Christ. He is writing to people who ought to know that God is really at the centre. But also to people who know that God has given himself to us in Jesus. And think of the steps of Jesus' life. Coming into this world as a baby, growing up in Galilee, teaching the disciples, arguing with the Pharisees, going about doing good, and going to the cross to die. For what? For self-centered people who fight and quarrel because they love themselves too much. For people who are such friends of the world that they hate God. For people like me. That is God's love for us. And that is the God who is at the centre. Suppose I do verse 10 and humble myself and step out from the centre. Suppose I pay attention to the God who is at the centre and live in front of him. I've got to live his way, haven't I? I can't just indulge myself in some fit of self-centred religion because the God I am supposed to live for, he has given himself in love to me, to you, to all of us. To live life with this God, I have to be his way. I have to give myself to you, to my wife, to my family, to God's people and God's world. Not trying to draw my last bit of pleasure out of them, but to serve and to do someone a bit of good. If I'm going to live life with God at the centre, then I need to use some other bits of my brain than just the pleasure bits. I need to think, what about the people around me? How can I serve them? How can I serve you? Now behave like that, and what happens to the fights and quarrels of verse 1? Being a toy, for me to be a toy in the hands of my passions is right out. Acting in love for the other person is in. Coveting is off the menu. Grace is on it. Friendship with the world is right out. Submit therefore to God is the order of the day. And if I happen to be involved with Zechariah and Elizabeth in their wedding, whether I am their parents or their friend or their relative or even the grumpy minister, if I am thinking of how Christ has been to me, their wedding is about them, not about me. Well, let's make it concrete. Have you got a verse one fight or quarrel going at the moment? Have you got one happening in your orbit right now? You might not, but think about it. And if you have got one happening, what is it about? Fill in the dotted line. And look hard at it. If you're in a quarrel, is there the least chance that the fight that I'm in has more to do with me feeling put out, with me feeling as though I'm not getting what I deserve, with me not getting my desires and passions in verse 1 and verse 2? Is there the least chance that the fight I'm in has more to do with that than with, say, right and wrong? Or that part of it has to do with that? The fact that the fight is still going on, has that got more to do with my pride, my need to come out on top, with my need to prove that I am right, my need to be the centre of everything? Has it got more to do with that than with right and wrong? Now suppose I shift myself from the driving seat of the universe and stand humble before God, before the God who gives himself in love. Can I stand humble in front of the person I'm fighting with and behave just a little bit like Jesus has been with me? Here's the big chance. Put James into action. If you've got a fight going on, if you've got a quarrel going on, do the Galilean revolution. Step out from the centre. Fix it up. And even if you haven't got any fight going on, passions at war, desiring and not having, friendship with the world, enmity with God, that is not who we want to be, is it? Verse 7. Submit yourselves to God. Step out from the centre and be part of the Galilean revolution.